From New Mexico to Maine, Virginia to Oregon, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, the left has been working overtime to give a negative meaning to the term Christian nationalism. But what does Christian nationalism actually mean? Jay Richards of the Heritage Foundation is here with the answer. Add Maryland to the list of states with competitive U.S. Senate races this year, and illegal immigration has become a top voter concern. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. Recovery from the tragic collapse of the Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore will likely be slowed by a protectionist law. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine is here to explain. And Vladimir Putin has been re-elected president of Russia, this following the suspicious death of his harshest critic. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College has this week's American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. The left has been working overtime to demonize the involvement of Christians in national affairs, attempting to stigmatize the term Christian nationalism. But what is Christian nationalism, and is it anything new? We turn to Jay Richards. He is a senior research fellow and director of the DeVos Center for Life, Religion, and the Family at the Heritage Foundation. Jay, welcome to American Radio Journal. Jay, the left and a lot of the national news media, sometimes one and the same, have been really trying to take the term Christian nationalism and turn it into something negative. First of all, what exactly is Christian nationalism?
Well, that's the problem with the term. It doesn't have any settled definition. And in fact, I would say for the last 3 years or so, the mainstream media has been, you know, on a campaign effectively to weaponize this term. If you tease out what they seem to mean by it, it's something like Christians who want to establish Christianity as the national religion and force unbelievers, I don't know, to get baptized or go to church or something like that. And if you define it that way, very few people, including very few conservative Christians or Americans, actually think that's a good idea. And if you look at the way the media has used this term, more often than not, they want to connect it to something negative, like establishing a theocracy. And yet the examples they use are of basically politically engaged conservative Christians who talk about the Christian role in the founding of the United States, that argue that we should be able to bring our faith to the public square. In other words, but completely uncontroversial American activities that would have been bipartisan 30 or 40 years ago is now, according to publications like Politico, some kind of nefarious plot by Christians to establish Christianity as the national religion.
If you look back, even relatively recent history here, Jay, going back into the Nixon years in the 1970s, mm-hmm. Christian movements in politics are not really anything new and usually are well-grounded in constitutional principles. So why this new effort to really slander Christians who simply want to practice our faith and also want to be involved in government and make sure that we have a government that's moral and ethical?
I mean, I honestly think it is a sign of just how deeply anti-religious and specifically anti-Christian so much of the media is. I mean, the idea that we can't use theological arguments in the public square, if that were right, Martin Luther King Jr. could not have given his famous I Have a Dream speech, which was explicitly theological. In fact, you can find a speech from a former University of Chicago professor around 2008 arguing that it's absurd that Christians should be told they can't bring their faith in the public square. That, by the way, that University of Chicago College professor went on to become the president of the United States. His name was Barack Obama. Joe Biden, the current occupant in the White House, it's really kind of flamboyant in at least identifying with his Christian faith. He carries a rosary, which he makes sure that the media see. The media doesn't seem to have a problem with that. What they have a problem with is conservative Christians supporting conservative ideas. And they hope to paint those of us that are described in that way as engaged in some kind of bizarre plot. That's what's so bizarre about it. And then what kind of makes this worse, I think, in some ways, is that some Christians sort of halfway onto the game say, well, fine then, if you're going to call us Christian nationalists, I'll just embrace the term. But I don't think that's an especially wise strategy, precisely because the term's been used by the media for several years in a weaponized way. And so all you're doing is effectively, for people that aren't following the debate, is associating yourself with something that creates bad mental pictures for a lot of people.
Interesting that you would bring up Dr. Martin Luther King, because going back even further than the Nixon years, going back into the 1960s and the struggle for various rights that took place during that era, didn't a lot of that actually originate in black churches? And in fact, even today, what is commonly now known as the Black National Anthem really is a Methodist Christian hymn. So how is it that the left can disparage Christianity, since it's been an integral part of bringing about human freedom over the last number of decades here?
Well, that's the truth of the matter. I mean, it's very, very difficult to account for the American constitutional order without some kind of broadly Christian background. In fact, it's impossible to make sense of the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution without just sort of understanding that for the founders, even the least orthodox of the founders, they actually thought the existence of a creator was a public truth. In other words, you could know that there is a creator. You could know that humans are made in their image with certain inalienable rights as a matter of reason. So the existence of a God is actually not considered sectarian, at least by the American founders. Now, unfortunately, if Christians make reference to God or talk about God giving us our rights, that's suddenly made sectarian. But these things were not considered sectarian for actually most of American history, which I think what this tells us is just how far removed the sort of official elite culture, which is represented in the mainstream media, has gotten from the kind of basic foundations of the American constitutional order.
How does all of this play into the ongoing national debate and the legal struggles that are taking place over abortion? Is this being weaponized largely to fight the pro-life movement?
That's exactly what's happening. And in fact, I think that the overturning of Roe v. Wade in 2022 really sort of gave energy to the secular left to sort of paint the whole debate over abortion as if it's entirely sectarian. But of course, the silly thing is anyone involved in the pro-life movement knows you can make perfectly public arguments for the pro-life cause without citing scripture, without citing any kind of sectarian belief. All you need is just the proposition that murder is wrong, some basic information from embryology about when human life begins, and you get the conclusion that it's wrong to take unborn human life. None of that depends on any kind of narrowly sectarian idea, unless you want to say that the idea that murder is wrong is somehow sectarian. But if that's the case, then actually we end up having no basis for our public laws at all.
We have been talking with Jay Richards, who is a senior research fellow, and he is also director of the DeVos Center for Life, Religion, and Family at the Heritage Foundation in Washington, D.C. Jay, tell us a little bit about the Heritage Foundation. Also, where can folks go on the web to find more information?
The Heritage Foundation is an officially nonpartisan but conservative public policy think tank right here in Washington, D.C., a few hundred yards from the Capitol. We've been advising political leaders and policy analysts for about 51 years. And anyone interested in our work can just check us out at our website at heritage.org.
Jay Richards of the Heritage Foundation. Jay, thank you for being with us.
My pleasure.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. He is intimately involved in a certain U.S. Senate race in Virginia this year, but we also have U.S. Senate races all around the country, as well as key congressional races. Congress now in recess, so we're going to take a few minutes today to take stock of where everything stands. Scott, good to have you here.
Great to be back, Loman. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's talk first about Congress here. Congress has adjourned for a while. We're soon going to be headed into the summer season where even less gets done. Should we expect much more out of this Congress?
We're at the point, I think, in 2024, everybody's got their eye on the prize for this big election. And I remember many, many years ago when the Democrats held power with Harry Reid, and he used to put forward some of the hardest votes in the United States Senate against Republican candidates that were up for re-election, and it would be a real political vulnerability for them. And obviously, in the way that the uniparty operates in Washington, D.C. now, we don't really see Republicans pushing the Democrats to the brink. But we did recently have some big, big immigration votes that were held on Laken Riley Act. Senator Budd from North Carolina had a big vote, got all the Democrats on the record. We got Democrats on the record saying that they support flying in illegal aliens from South America and elsewhere, right directly into the United States of America. And so there were a few Republican senators that I would say went rogue in exchange for passing that terrible appropriations bill just over a week ago. And the fundamental point here that I think all the listeners need to consider is that we do have some political ammunition. And the question is, how are we going to use it against senators like Tim Kaine? How are we going to use it against John Tester and Sherrod Brown? And how are we going to win back the Senate majority? There's many, many competitive races. In addition to the states that I mentioned there, we've got Arizona and Nevada and Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania. I think that we're in shape right now for a very, very good electoral outcome. And of course, when you look at the presidential race, there's a lot of independent voices out there that are completely dissatisfied with the president, President Biden's job approval, his performance, and they're ready to vote to make a change. I think that means that we get a Republican Senate majority, and I think that that means that Donald Trump is going to get reelected in 2024.
Some of these U.S. Senate races are somewhat predictable. I think Republicans have very high hopes, of course, in West Virginia, where Joe Manchin is not running for reelection. That, of course, a huge state for Donald Trump. In the last couple of weeks, there's been some polling, Scott, where the state of Maryland, which is usually reliably Democrat, appears to be in play when it comes to the U.S. Senate race. What are you seeing there?
Well, Larry Hogan is the former governor of Maryland, and I think that the party insiders that are getting all excited about this, to me, it's another one of these moderate, bipartisan-type governors that his record is what it is. Would he be a Republican vote in terms of adding to the majority? Of course. But how will he actually vote when he gets in there? I think that we need Republican candidates that are going to fight back against the status quo. And to me, that means we're going to fight back against the overspending. That means we're going to fight for free markets. That means that we're going to fight for our constitutional rights. And that means that we're going to fight this illegal alien invasion that we've got on the southern border. And all these candidates that are out there, I think the voters need to ask them very directly, where do they stand on those important issues? What other issues matter to them? What are we going to do about election integrity? What are we going to do about school choice? What are we going to do about the cost of living in America? And I think that those questions will be answered differently depending on which state some of these folks live in. Obviously, Maryland has a Democrat governor. They've got two Democrat senators right now, Ben Cardin retiring. That one is going to be a competitive race. Larry Hogan is going to be the Republican nominee. And I guess the question is, what type of senator would he be if he's elected?
You, of course, have been out among the grassroots very heavily in the Commonwealth of Virginia, the Old Dominion here over the last number of months here, Scott. What are you hearing as you talk to regular people, not the pollsters, not the Washington insiders, but you're out there, you're talking with actual voters who live their everyday lives. What are their main concerns? Is immigration actually at the top of the list these days?
I think that it is. We've seen all across communities the rapes, the murders. There was another murder in Michigan this week. This is hitting all communities and all people. And so I think the fentanyl crisis is also borne by the illegal immigration crisis. And there's just a lot of people that are sick and tired of not feeling safe in their communities. And I think that in addition to all that, there's a big, big question about jobs and the economy and sort of how these smaller communities are almost dying off. And, you know, my hometown was a hometown of about 11,000 people, and large amount of the people that are employed in that small town are supported by one or two job providers. And ultimately, when you see some of these corporate interests or large small businesses move to a more competitive landscape, to be closer to more consumers or just to have better benefits for their employees, they're moving toward larger cities and the suburbs. And so I think that's why you're seeing sort of this explosion in terms of economic activity in places like Northern Virginia. But what does that mean for rural Virginia? What does that mean for rural America? What does it mean for Main Street businesses? And that's definitely on the minds of a lot of these grassroots voters that I speak to every single day.
On the other side of the Capitol Rotunda, of course, Republicans down to, what, about a one-seat majority in the U.S. Congress. Just very briefly and at a high-level overview, where do you see the competitive races for congressional seats headed at this early stage in the 2024 race?
We know that through redistricting, it's almost a wash in terms of the seats that we're going to pick up in North Carolina compared to the seats that we're going to lose in New York. We know that we lost a congressional district in Alabama due to a court case there. And then when you think about how the lines were redrawn just a couple of years ago, there aren't as many competitive races. I think that the National Republican Congressional Committee, the NRCC, has roughly 30 races that they're sort of targeting here. And some of them are stretch races if we have a really good night. Others are very, very competitive on a bad night. And the majority that we have right now, one-seat majority following Ken Buck's retirement and Mike Gallagher's announcement, that is very much not going to be growing to a 40-seat majority like we've had in the past.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. We always like to end our little talks here, Scott, by having you tell us a little bit about the Club.
Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C. You can check us out at clubforgrowth.org. And
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you. Talk to you next week.
Okay, thank you.
An old protectionist law could slow the effort to reopen the Port of Baltimore in the wake of the tragic collapse of the Francis Scott Key Bridge. Eric Boehm joins us with details.
The sudden collapse of Baltimore's Francis Scott Key Bridge in the early hours of Tuesday this week after it was hit by a fully loaded cargo ship was a shocking and tragic event. Our thoughts and prayers certainly are with the families of those who were killed, a group of construction workers on the bridge that were killed in that accident. But as we move from the immediacy of that tragedy and we move on towards the recovery and the rebuilding phase of what is going to have to happen there in that stretch of the harbor in Baltimore, I think that will put some focus, some attention on one weird protectionist law that's going to make that whole process costlier and probably much more time-consuming. And that's what we're going to take a look at today. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. The bridge, of course, the Francis Scott Key Bridge there, is a key link in the beltway that goes around the city of Baltimore, and it crosses over the only access point between the harbor and the Chesapeake Bay, which, of course, connects out to the ocean and to all the global supply lines that flow through it. So the collapse of the bridge certainly going to cause some traffic issues around Baltimore, but the bigger problem is probably the way in which the downed bridge will affect maritime activity in the port of Baltimore. And this is one of the biggest ports on the East Coast. It is actually the largest port for bringing cars and trucks into the country, but then, of course, lots of other goods flow through there as well. It remains unclear for now exactly how long the port will be closed, but Federal Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg said Wednesday that there is likely to be a long and difficult path ahead. In the meantime, trade flowing through the port will have to be redirected to other ports along the East Coast. That's a disruption, a marginal one, but perhaps a significant one that could mean higher costs and other complications. This is, of course, a particularly acute issue for the roughly 15,000 workers who earn a living off the commerce that passes through Baltimore's port, either workers who work directly at the port or those who work in jobs that support the activities at the port. All of those people facing a lot of economic uncertainty at the moment. So clearly, you know, for big picture economic reasons and also for those very specific reasons dealing with the workers at the port, clearly there's every reason to make sure that the Port of Baltimore can be reopened as quickly as possible. And Buttigieg acknowledged as much on Wednesday during that same press conference. He said that the White House had given him a clear directive to tear down any barriers, bureaucratic as well as financial, to getting the port reopened. But Buttigieg stopped short of naming any specific federal regulations that might be waived to speed along these recovery efforts. So here's an idea for him. Here's one that should go right at the top of Pete Buttigieg's list. The Foreign Dredge Act of 1906. Yes, it's a law you've probably never heard about before. The Foreign Dredge Act is basically an older cousin of the slightly more well-known and more infamous Jones Act. Now, the Jones Act, which, again, many people probably aren't all that familiar with, bans foreign-built ships from moving goods between American ports. And at Reason.com, for years, we have followed kind of the just economic stupidity that comes from the Jones Act. It drives up shipping costs between the mainland United States and places like Puerto Rico and Hawaii because it limits which ships can actually carry cargo to those places. It adds traffic to American highways because it means that you can't ship goods on a boat. You can't ship goods on a foreign-built boat from, say, Boston to Florida. You have to put that stuff on a truck or pay higher ocean shipping costs. And it leaves sizable portions of the country without access to natural gas. I wrote a story a couple of years ago for a reason about how there's huge parts of Alaska where there's no access to natural gas for heating. Even though Alaska produces a significant chunk of the country's natural gas, it's much easier actually to send it overseas than it is to use it here, which just makes no sense at all. Now, like the Jones Act, the Foreign Dredge Act is a purely protectionist law that forbids foreign-built dredges. Dredges are vessels used to move debris out of waterways or to deepen and widen shipping channels. It prohibits those vessels from operating in the U.S., again, if they weren't built in the U.S. So any foreign dredge that's caught doing work in American waters is subject to immediate forfeiture by the federal government. The law, when it was passed more than 100 years ago, was meant to protect American dredge building companies from foreign competition. But more than a century later, the primary outcome of the Foreign Dredge Act has been to severely curtail the number of dredges available to do important work, like removing the wreckage of the Key Bridge. And many of the ones that are in use in the United States are substandard compared to the rest of the world. The Army Corps of Engineers is still using dredges built in the 1930s. And a recent study from Tulane University found that the combined capacity of the U.S. dredge fleet is less than the largest European Union dredging vessel. All the American dredges combined can move less stuff than just one vessel that exists in the EU. So why don't we have access to better dredges? It's because the American dredge building companies have been shielded from competition for over a century. They haven't had to keep up with developments made elsewhere in the world. So clearing away the debris and reopening the Port of Baltimore is likely to depend on outdated equipment and will therefore take a lot longer than it otherwise might. Now, waiving the Foreign Dredge Act might help in some small way in the short term. Perhaps it means a better dredge could be brought down from Canada or from somewhere else in the world. But the collapse of the Key Bridge is a great reminder that we shouldn't wait until there's a crisis to start undoing bad laws. It would have been better to repeal the Foreign Dredge Act 5 years ago, or 10 years ago, or 50 years ago, so that America would already have access to the best dredging technology in the world. So what happens next will be pretty telling. Will the Biden administration follow through on its promise to sweep aside policies that will slow the recovery in Baltimore? Or will it choose counterproductive protectionism over the interests of the East Coast's economy and 15,000 blue-collar workers? For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. You can check out more of our coverage of this law and other stupid protectionist economic policies at Reason.com. We are always writing about that stuff up there, so check it out. And you can catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Following the mysterious death of his highest profile critic, Vladimir Putin has once again been reelected president of Russia. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College has analysis on this American Radio Journal commentary.
Death solves all problems. No man, no problem. So declared Joseph Stalin, the murderous tyrant whose own death arrived on March 5, 1953, 5 months after the birth of Vladimir Putin. Stalin's death solved a great problem for his vast nation's countless suffering citizens. His ultimate successor, Nikita Khrushchev, would denounce Stalin and his crimes of Stalin's speech. And speaking of crimes, it's difficult to find a worse criminal in today's Russia or anywhere in the world than Vladimir Putin. Putin clearly subscribes to Stalin's death recipe. Back in July, he had his old friend Yevgeny Prigozhin, the Wagner Group leader who had led a rebellion against him, blown out of the sky with a conveniently timed airplane explosion. This past February, he had his main political rival, Alexei Navalny, eliminated in a Siberian gulag. Death solves all problems. No man, no problem. One person who doesn't feel so glib about death is Alexei Navalny's widow, Yulia, the mother of his two children. Both Yulia and Alexei's own mother received reports that their loved one's corpse showed significant signs of bruising, even as Kremlin officials told them that he had died of something they called sudden death syndrome. They insisted that Alexei's body cannot be sent home until an official investigation is completed, one of unknown duration. How Stalin-esque. How Putin-esque. Yulia is, of course, outraged. She accuses Vladimir Putin of being downright demonic. Yes, she actually used those words. In his mistreatment of her husband. Choice words. Her words ought to be a wake-up call to the weird American Putinists who find reasons to defend and sometimes even praise the Russian despot. Among their reasons, they see Putin as a faithful Russian traditionalist and Christian. From Yulia's vantage, however, she discerns quite the opposite. She says, quote, "We already knew that Putin's faith was fake, but now we see it more clearly than ever before. No true Christian could ever do what Putin is now doing with Alexei's body." She continued, pleading to the dictator Putin in a message on YouTube, quote, "Give us back the body of my husband. We want to hold a funeral service and bury him in a humane way, in the ground, as is customary in Orthodox Christianity," unquote. In an interesting juxtaposition, Yulia noted that her husband actually was a devout Christian whose faith inspired his views and his courage. In fact, Alexei Navalny not only went to church, but in the gulag, he was actually fasting during the Lenten season. Yes, even while in a Siberian prison. Alexei Navalny made sacrifices. Putin, in turn, sacrificed Alexei. But more to the point, Alexei Navalny's elimination helps Vladimir Putin solve another problem. Namely, Navalny now no longer exists to challenge Vlad's next presidential election this March 2024. And that election is, has been, the next pivotal episode in the deadly authoritarian rule of Vladimir Putin, which has taken this winding road. Namely, on December 31st, 1999, Boris Yeltsin, Russia's first freely elected president ever in the country's long history, announced he was resigning the presidency, which at that point in his two terms had only a few months remaining. Yeltsin was worn out, and so he turned over the reins to his prime minister, Vladimir Putin. Putin then duly stood for the presidential election in March of 2000. He won easily and fairly. 4 years later, he won handily again. And at that point, frankly, honestly, was a popular president. Putin liked the job so much that he found a way after March 2008 to exceed the 2 4-year term limits on the president, according to the Russian Constitution. By 2020 and 2021, through a referendum and a new Russian law, Putin creatively created a way to allow himself to run for 2 more presidential terms, this time 6-year terms, potentially extending his rule into 2030 and even 2036. So if you're keeping track with all of my dates here, former KGB Lieutenant Colonel Vladimir Putin, his reign should have ended in March 2008. It's now up to 2024, headed for 2030, and will frankly continue as long as a 71-year-old desires to stay in power. When Alexei Navalny was alive, Vladimir Putin had a viable popular competitor, even as Navalny really had no chance in a rigged game. But with Navalny altogether eliminated, Putin could run virtually uncontested. After all, death solves all problems. No man, no problem. For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengor. Thanks for listening.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WNVY-AM and WVTJ-AM in Pensacola, Florida, along with WCPC-AM in Tupelo, Mississippi. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.